This box here is for our newcomer ask portion of the program. Hopefully you saw it in the back of the room. There's also a stack of 3x5 cards back there and a couple of pens. And what we like to have happen is for people that have questions about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, they write their questions down on those cards, put them in the slot here. And then we come up here and pick out a question, and using our panel of experts and AA-approved literature, we attempt to answer that question. And we have one for tonight. The question is, how old was Bill W. when he took his first drink, and how old when he took his last drink? How old was he when he died, and how much sobriety total? And this was submitted by Tim from Toledo. And we're going to answer that question with this book, which is Pass It On, which is the story of Bill Wilson and how the AA message reached the world. To address the first point, how old was Bill W. when he took his first drink? He was 21, and that comes from page 56 of Pass It On. He was 21 years old, a second lieutenant in the United States Army, about to leave for World War I in France. He was 21 years old. This was in 1918. The circumstances under which he had his first drink, I'm going to read a little bit from the book. Well, my self-consciousness was such that I simply had to take that drink, he recalled. He's at a dinner party with a family there in Massachusetts. So I took it, and another one, and then lo, the miracle. That strange barrier that had existed between me and all men and women seemed to instantly go down. I felt that I belonged to where I was, belonged to life. I belonged to the universe. I was a part of things at last. Oh, the magic of those first three or four drinks. I became the life of the party. I actually could please the guests. I could talk freely, volubly. I could talk well. I became suddenly very attracted to these people and fell into a whole series of dates. But I think even that first evening, I got thoroughly drunk. And within the next time or two, I passed out completely. But as everybody drank hard, nothing too much was made of that. That was his first experience with drinking. The second point of the question, how old was he when he took his last drink? That's from page 120 of Pass It On. Sequence of events work like this. You know, Bill has been struggling to quit drinking for some time. He ends up going to the Oxford group, think he has the answer, but he wants to go to Towns Hospital one last time. On the way to the hospital, he stops at the grocery store, gets four bottles of beer, and drinks three of them on the way to the hospital. So when he shows up there, he's already been drinking when he met Dr. Silkworth there at the hospital. That day of his last drink was December 11th, 1934. How old was he when he died? And how much sobriety total? He died on November 24th, 1971, at which point he was 75 years old and had 36 years of sobriety. Thank you, Tim from Toledo, for that question. Remember, these answers come out of AA-approved literature, and when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, hand them AA-approved literature. And it is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member of the fellowship since 1989. Starting in Bethesda, Maryland, he's been a member in San Diego, Pensacola, Florida, Okinawa, Japan, Orange County, and Fresno. Continually in service, he started by emptying ashtrays and went on to be a secretary, treasurer, and GSR. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, California, Mike H.
I'm Mike, and I'm an alcoholic, and thank you for the welcome. Just going to do the seventh tradition here. And I have not found it necessary to take a drink due to the grace of God in this program since August 25th, 1989. And for that miracle, among other things, I'm very grateful. I need to always keep track of the clock because I tend to run my mouth. So as I was taught by a sponsor, things I learn in AA, I try to apply out of AA. And I took my first drink when I was 14 years old. I was born in an average, although I'm now grateful for my family, a church that now I'm grateful for. And there was some alcoholism in my family, probably not any more or any less than some other families. Two parents that did the best they could, loving parents, not perfect, but I've since learned that nobody's perfect. And I didn't have any real reason to get drunk except the fact that when I started ninth grade, the kids at school who I looked up to, who I thought were sophisticated and cool, the guys that were getting the girls, the guys that made the teams, they were drinking. And they called it partying. Now, that was probably around 1979, 1980. And most of it was alcohol, and there was a few other assorted grasses and other things. And I just knew that I wanted to look, I did not feel I felt just like what I look back now as a typical teenager. Totally insecure, you know, head up my other orifice, just trying to figure out which way to take it out. And I look back and I see teenagers now and most of them are like that. There's a few exceptions on each side. Some are super, super sophisticated. And when I took that first drink, I wanted to feel the way they looked. I wanted to feel inside the way they looked. We all get here different ways, and you know, you read our literature and you go to a lot of meetings and you listen to people share. I believe I never had to cross the line into problem drinking. I started out problem drinking. I was on the other side of the line right away because I was drinking from the beginning for the effect produced by the alcohol. I was sneaking nips out of the liquor cabinet. I bought some cigarettes and I bought some chewing tobacco, anything I could get my hands on. And I waited till an afternoon where my mom took my sister to a doctor's appointment or something, and I went in the backyard of our house up in Fresno, and in a corner behind the bushes, I smoked and I drank as much liquor combined with wine, pomegranate wine from Casa de Fruta, by the way, and Coors beer. So I mixed them all. I drank as much as I possibly could. And then it hit me. Just now I knew why people liked alcohol. And I remember having the feeling that I could literally walk on air. I don't know how long the feeling lasted because I blacked out. And I vomited all over the front yard and the backyard and my bed and the house. And I came to with them hosing me off in the shower. My brother had to drag my mattress outside in the backyard. And my parents were just terrified. I remember the next morning I was deathly ill. I was sick as a dog. I remember that night walking with my dad out in the neighborhood, and my dad said to me, "Your mother's worried you're an alcoholic." And I look back. Mom was right. She nailed it right then. And as sick as I was that day, I did not forget that brief good feeling. And I was determined that I was going to do that again. And it started out, for the most part, going to the dances and then breaking off and going to a liquor store in the neighborhood and trying to find somebody we called a pimping beer. Pay somebody to buy us beer who had an ID. And we used to just walk around the neighborhoods and get drunk. That's, you know, I look back, that's not very healthy, but that's what we did. And and then later the next year, the solitary drinking continued. I'd come home from a football game. My parents might be out of town, and so I could sit there and just stay up 3 or 4 hours into the early morning and just drink as much as I wanted to. Because I knew already that it was not safe for me to drink the way I wanted to in public. And I continued to keep drinking. Somehow I made it through high school without getting in a lot of trouble. Somehow I got into college. I took that SAT test. I'm sure I was hungover. And, you know, I was just a scared kid. You know, I wanted to be liked. I felt terribly shy and insecure, especially with women. Back then, girls. I was already hitting periods of depression in high school because life wouldn't go my way. I look back and, but I had, you know, I had that, what we now call the obsession of the mind, and I had the allergy of the body. When the alcohol got in my system, I wanted more. I'm amazed I was able to control it enough that I didn't have many public incidents. I usually saved it and binged when I got home. Somehow I made it into college, and I was pretty driven because I wanted to get into a school out after college and maybe go into the service. But I drank a lot in college. I joined a fraternity. There were a couple of times where I was sick for a whole week. And I didn't think there was anything really wrong with that. I knew part of me didn't. I knew the solitary drinking was probably not normal. But I continued to have, when I wasn't drunk, the anxiety and it's kind of funny. He read that book, Pass It On, where Bill was. Or our co-founder was very open about his insecurities with people and in life, where I had to be the best just to fit in, which wasn't going to happen in a lot of things. Because at that time, I really didn't have the willingness. Somehow I got through college, and I got into the military, and I got into this program I wanted to get into to learn a skill and a profession. And I went back to Washington, D.C. Now I had a little bit of money in my pocket. I was the equivalent rank in the Navy as Bill, an ensign in the Navy. And I started to really binge. I mean, I had my own car. I had alcohol. I had a place I was sharing with a roommate, but I had time on my own, and there was a lot of drinking in the service, and there was a lot of, I look back now, there's lots of drinking everywhere. I've lived in a foreign country when I was in the service. The Japanese really know how to drink.
I just want to report that to you. And the second year over there, I really, really started drinking. And, you know, I had the blackouts and the hangovers. And my time when I was sober, I was expected to be an adult and to show up and to do what I was being paid to do. And it just became harder and harder. And then the insecurity and the anxiety and the depression that we read about continued to get more and more intense in between the drunks. So somewhere around that second year, I started seeing the shrink. Of course, I never told the shrink about my binging, because that would have gotten me locked up in a heartbeat. The Navy already had a program that they started in the early 70s, of which I've had several sponsors who graduated from, where they were sending people to treatment, and they had a way of locking you up and sending you there without either that, or they'll kick you out and send you a bill for the training, which didn't sound good. And I remember just drinking more and more, and what I was trying to do, I wanted to arrange my life so that I could have everything I wanted, everything my way, money, women, prestige, the approval of people I looked up to, and yet still be able to binge whenever I wanted to. And if I would have found a way to pull that off, I probably wouldn't be here. Remember that there's a part in the big book they talk about a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I didn't really think I was an alcoholic. I thought I had a split personality. I thought I had part of me that wanted to be good and to do what I was taught by my family and my church and my coaches. And then I had this part of me that just wanted to be totally drunk and do whatever the hell I wanted. And usually those things were not socially acceptable. So I was getting to the point where the drinking was not working anymore. And I was getting more and more depressed. And I would make depressed phone calls to relatives, sometimes drunk, which is not a good thing to do. And, you know, people really cared about me. And I also had this attitude that everything I had gotten in life was through my own efforts. I was not very grateful. I remember screaming that to my poor aunt on the phone one night. And I also remember, it might have been that night, I was hungover that evening, and I was supposed to be, you know, studying and doing things for my job. And instead I walked over to a rectory, which is a little building next to any Catholic church. It was a Wednesday evening or something like that. And I banged on the door where probably where the nuns live. And I was thinking, you know, this is my last ditch. I was this dramatic, depressed, self-pitying, drunk. And I remember thinking, you know, maybe they'll have some sympathy for me. And then they never answered the door. It was like 7:30, you know. It wasn't the greatest area around D.C., and they're probably looking out the window saying, who's this psycho? And I left thinking, you know, oh, God even turned his back on me. Poor me. But you know what? 3 weeks later, I got locked up on the psych ward. And what led up to that was I started to open up a little bit at work to someone, and this lady had some experience dealing with alcoholics. And she referred me to an alcoholic military officer there where I was working. And he sat down with me, and he shared about what happened to him. And he made me realize that I might be an alcoholic.
And then he said, well, you're going to have to stop drinking. And I remember saying, for like 6 months, right? I could not accept mentally, I could not get my head around the fact that I could never get drunk again. And that's the only reason I drank alcohol. You know, I laugh now at people. I hear people who do wine tasting. I mean, for me, I'm an alcoholic, though. Not all people, I've met normal people since I've been sober. Okay? Not all people drink with the same motivation that I drink. So get drunk. You know, men and women drink essentially whatever, because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't hoard bottled water or strawberries. I hoarded anything. And near the end, I was hoarding the most potent stuff I could legally buy. Jägermeister 151. I was mixing it in like punch, because it would destroy I would burn my throat so bad going down. I wasn't able to really get myself on some illicit substances to help me. The only reason I wanted them was to help me drink more and help me recover quicker. And that wouldn't have been a good idea in the military, because that really would have gotten me in trouble. And I knew that the few times I used any additional adjuncts or helpers, that I just drank more and got in more trouble. So basically, I got to the point where it says, where I really couldn't get drunk anymore. I just passed out. Woke up, hungover, no buzz. I remember sometimes sitting in a room, dark room, blasting rock into my head, drinking as much as I could, and setting the alarm to see if I could, because I was too impatient to wait for the buzz to start. I mean, that's just total insanity. But for an alcoholic, if you go to meetings, nothing surprises us. Now, normal people will really not look, they're a little scared when they hear stuff like that. Most of us, if you identify with that in a meeting, you might need to be here. Or if you laugh when you hear these stories, that's a good sign that you just might want to have an open mind. Because normal people, you know, I mean, drinking until you vomit and drinking more, that doesn't seem to alarm anybody here. It doesn't alarm me. So I got to that point where I really, and I was too cowardly to try to kill myself. And I got to the point where I gave up, and I listened to them, and they said, you're going to have to go to treatment. And I thought I would get some time off and then get to go to treatment, because they flew me to Long Beach. And they said, no, we're going to keep you in the psych ward until you go to treatment. And I remember calling some colonel and threatening him with a congressional investigation with my little pajamas on and my little bracelet. And he just said, thank you for sharing, Michael, something to that effect. But, you know, my roommates came and they took me to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings that week. They got permission to take me out to meetings and then back to the psych ward. And they were pretty stunned. But they had been noticing some odd behavior around the house for quite a while. The stocks of beer in the basement were disappearing. One of my roommates found me laying there. My face was camouflaged, and he just was really scared. But, you know, in that treatment center, they basically educated me about alcohol. Fortunately, this was in Long Beach now, they took us to meetings in a bus every night of the week. And then I think on Thursdays at noon, they brought in a hospital and institutions panel that brought a meeting to us. And I started to identify. They read chapters, parts from the big book and the 12x12. And I started to identify. And to show you how crazy alcoholics, I remember, like, roommates of mine, they had four of us to a room. It didn't matter, officers enlisted. There was a Marine young kid, a corporal, and there was a Navy captain who'd taken care of president's wives in there. It didn't matter.
And I remember near the end of the treatment thing, they told us that when we got out, an old timer actually said it, you better find a meeting, a home group, you better find meetings for every day of the week, you better get a sponsor, or most of you are going to get drunk again. And that scared me. And it scared me enough that when I got out, I started going to meetings on a regular basis because I knew how I was. The only thing I'd ever been consistent at in life was being inconsistent, as I've heard some other speakers say. And I would have bet on me that I would have gone to 2 meetings a day for the first week, then down to 1 meeting a day, then the next week 3 meetings, and then the following week 1 meeting, and then it would be every other week, and then it would be every other month. And I was terrified because I knew that's the way I am. And I'm still scared of that. And it might have something to do with the time of sobriety I have. I've never taken any leaves of absence from meetings. And I've fortunately been able to find meetings all over the world. There are English-speaking meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in every major city on this planet. And there were times I didn't have transportation. It didn't matter. I made a phone call, and they met me. Someone came and picked me up, or someone told me, take this bus line. Heck, in Japan, on the website, they had step-by-step directions of which train to change, which subway to take. And sometimes we'd get together, and we'd spend an hour and 45 minutes each way to go to a one-hour meeting. But I was sponsoring a guy. I had to go. And I didn't want to get drunk. Because people in the military drink a lot overseas. They drink a lot, period, but they really drink a lot overseas. And, you know, I didn't want to drink. And I've always had a sponsor. I believe what they say when they say, you know, don't sponsor yourself. It's like when a judge says, you know, and don't represent yourself. Maybe you have the right to, but if you watch any TV or, you know, a lot of courtroom stuff, they still appoint someone like as a standby because it's not wise to sponsor yourself. And so I've not engaged in that experiment. I've always had a sponsor, and usually I got desperate enough that I would actually call the sponsor and use the sponsor. And the sponsor that I had in San Diego, I was one or two years sober, and I made an attempt through the steps, which was a good attempt. But I I wasn't ready at that time. And he saw how desperate I was emotionally because I got to the point where my grace period was over and that I was left with my defects and my personality twists. And if I didn't start growing up and using the steps to get some help, I was going to have to get out. I was either going to blow my brains out or I was going to get drunk, and those options did not appeal to me because I didn't want to go back to a psych ward. And he saw I was willing enough. He said, okay, be at my house on this tonight. Bring the big book, bring the 12x12, and bring a dictionary. And I thought I was so smart. I had a college degree. I found out I wasn't that smart. And he had me look up a lot of words. And, you know, I'm kind of a tough, slow learner. I've never been accused of being a quick learner all the way back. And I remember, you know, I was able to use that 12x12 to help me understand the big book better. So that when I did the assignments he gave me in the big book, I did them. I did the resentment list. And just about every human being I'd ever interacted with, I had some type of resentment, or I was jealous of, or I was even resentful against my sponsor. I had to admit that because he hung up on me so many times. And so he took me through the steps. He said, you got to do it. He said, and you got to make the amends to people. And it was very important because, you know, there were amends I thought I needed to make. And he said, no, the best amend you can make to her is to leave her alone. Okay. And there were other amends I thought I didn't need to make. He said, no, you need to make that amend. And that's why it helps to have a sponsor in this program. And that big book is not very easy to read sometimes, and that's why I needed a sponsor. And some old-timer told me, in your weekly schedule of meetings. Make sure you have a big book study and a step study. That's where I found most of my sponsors. I haven't found them in bars. That's where I found sponsees too. Or they found me. And when he took me through the steps, he said, all I'm doing is taking you through the steps with this book the way it was done with me, so you can do it with somebody else. That's all it is. It's not a big deal. And when I finished that, he made me learn about the traditions, and then he made me read AA Comes of Age, which will definitely cure insomnia if you're having trouble sleeping. But I look back at that, I had to learn, because all these little spats we have in meetings everywhere, it's all happened before, because we're drunks. But I had to learn about that, and I mean, I'm still learning about it. There's more service opportunities in this program than we can ever do in a lifetime. You know, I don't have to do it all today. My sponsor had to tell me, you can only have one commitment at this time, period, because you've got to do other things too. You know, he wanted me to practice the principles outside the rooms instead of just inside the rooms. That's kind of a novel concept for an alcoholic like me. And that's another miracle. I've always was introduced to taking meetings into either treatment centers or hospitals or jails or prisons. And I've always done that. I always try to have one service commitment in my group, and I always try to have some commitment where I'm taken, because I got to get out of myself. My first sponsor said, you tend to worry a lot about yourself. And it says in the book, you know, the alcoholic or something with Alcoholics Anonymous and doing the work overcomes their excessive concentration on themselves. And it is a spiritual path. And my sponsor said, spiritual for you means, you know, everything between the electrons. You know, it's a spiritual program. It means I have to work on my honesty. I have to work on my faith, on my hope, on my willingness. It's not a financial program, you know, where I get money. It's not a chemical program where I take a drug. It's not a sports program or whatever. It's a spiritual program. And because of the, you know, it says in that 12x12, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, something. Spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can enable the sufferer become happily and usefully whole. That's a pretty good promise for anybody, for a non-alcoholic. And I never had that. I never had self-respect. And I've continued to go through things in sobriety that, you know, my higher power, who I choose to call God, you know, an old timer I heard said, God will not withhold any good thing from you if you're ready for it. And my timing is usually wrong, but God's timing is always right. I'm learning that. And I also love the saying, you know, don't leave before the miracle happens. Because a lot of us go back out and go to the graves, or worse. I remember some guy sharing at a meeting in Hawaii when I was in the service. He was more afraid of not dying from this disease. He was more afraid of just going in and out and in and out and into this prison and this psych ward. You know, and with a bad economy, it's not a good time to be in a prison or a psych ward. Not that there's ever a good time. And I continued to learn, you know, sponsoring people and trying to work with new people. We were working with a homeless guy a couple months ago, and the guy was tweaking, and he started screaming and threatening my buddy and I in a parking lot up at a meeting in Fresno, the same meeting where you came to. And this guy's pretty big, and he was totally psychotic. We were about ready to call the cops. And he threw his 24-hour chip right at my feet. I hang on to that. So that reminds me where I can go. If I just, you know, my old sponsor in San Diego said, if I want, there's a mat for me to claim. It, this was in San Diego, 11th and Island, the Volunteers of America shelter. He said, there's a mat there with every type of bodily fluid, and some probably won't be your own, that you can lay in if you want to claim it, if you want to go back out and drink.
And I'll try to wrap it up. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program, you know, like it says in the preamble, that's the best answer that I can give to anybody. Just like whenever I've been asked questions, I had a lady come in a meeting several years ago, and she said, you know, I had a problem with drugs. Can I come to your meeting? And I thought, you know, what? I don't have to think. I just looked at I read the third tradition. It said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And she goes, I have a desire to stop drinking too. She says, come on in. I don't have to make it up. You know, my sponsor said, don't use my original thinking. Use my experience. What I tell you, you should be able to find in the big book. And because I was clueless. I look back now about life, and I was clueless about what I was getting into with alcohol. You know, it's like just some fool that thinks he can get on a bull, ride a bull, and think, I'll know when to get off. You know, I'll get off right before it throws me down and tramples me. And that's the attitude I had about alcoholism, because I started to realize that, you know, it might not have a happy ending. So I continue to go to meetings regularly. I need meetings more now than I did when I first got here. And I try to practice this program and teach it the way we're taught how to do it here and the way my sponsors taught me. And like I said, it's one way to recover from alcoholism. It says we don't... Maybe there's other ways. I've seen people come in and they never drank again, and they go fine, and they, however they want to do it, their church or whatever. But for me, this is the easiest, most convenient, most available, least expensive way to recover, continue to recover from alcoholism, and I'll keep doing the things.